Hi, I'm Ashley, a true crime fanatic.
I'm Dan, and I don't know anything about true crime.
Together, we host Fuck That, a true crime podcast that covers cases that highlight important topics that are often overlooked, such as wrongful convictions, domestic violence, and social inequities, sprinkled in with the occasional case with spooky themes. If you are looking for your next true crime fix delivered candidly with a hint of sarcasm, you can listen and subscribe to bi-weekly episodes of Fuck That wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to give us a follow on Facebook and Twitter at FThatPod and at F_that_pod on Instagram.
Hola, my beautiful humans. This is Jasmine Castillo, and I bring stories and cases from the people of color community, bringing awareness of murdered and missing Indigenous women, girls, Two-Spirits, the LGBTQ community, Asian American, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander, Black Indigenous people of color. These are their stories. So, welcome to Hands Off, my podcast. Hello, my homekins. Welcome to episode 53. Today's guest is founder of a private nonprofit intelligence organization called Deliver Fund. We discuss the fight against human trafficking, his great expertise on modern-day slavery, and a plethora of knowledge is handed to all my listeners, especially to my dear families that need hope in finding their missing loved ones. If you're interested in the full interview of my guests from the podcast, you can view it on YouTube at handsofmypod/playlists. Let's dive right in, shall we? We've got a lot to cover.
So my name's Nick McKinley. I'm the founder and CEO of actually multiple companies, but one of them is Deliver Fund. We're a private nonprofit intelligence organization that equips, trains, and advises law enforcement for the fight against human trafficking. And not just law enforcement, actually. We work with industry partners. We work with kind of anybody who is adjacent to the human trafficking problem to provide them with data and technology and training so that they can be effective in that fight.
Can you share any relevant experience you had in combating human trafficking or working with law enforcement agencies? And I think you even mentioned with just people who are interested in taking up that fight against human trafficking.
Well, it kind of all started just by way of background. I spent a number of years in military special ops, and then I was recruited to the Central Intelligence Agency and was working in a unit there in Lashkargah, Afghanistan. And we had this human trafficking intel, kind of like what I like to call smoking gun intel on a human trafficker. But that's kind of all that they were doing was just trafficking children across the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. And when we tried to find somebody to do something about this, because our job was counter-narcotics and counterterrorism down there, human trafficking was not something we were supposed to be focused on. So when we looked around for somebody who was doing something about this, couldn't find anybody. And that was a light bulb moment for me where I thought to myself, wait a minute, we can kill people with flying robots from 6,000 miles away, but we don't have anybody focused on this human trafficking issue. That can't be true. And I just started looking throughout the federal government to see who was doing what. And I found there were federal agencies like Department of Homeland Security and elements within the FBI who were doing a good job, but there was just not very many of them. And that really, when you looked at the human trafficking problem, dollar for dollar, the largest human trafficking market was the United States of America. And we have over 18,000 law enforcement entities across the United States, none of which are really connected in the same platforms, and none of which focus on the human trafficking issue. And so what I decided to do was basically take the counterterrorism methodologies and a lot of the technologies that we knew worked really well in the counterterrorism fight and started to apply those to the counter human trafficking fight. And that started with one law enforcement officer. And that one law enforcement officer has now turned into over 450 law enforcement agencies across the United States.
Wow, that is amazing. So Deliver Fund has been established for how many years?
We're in our ninth year. Yeah, so this is in 2 years, this will be the thing that I have done the longest. I will have done this longer than I was in the military. I was in the Air Force in the pararescue teams.
That's interesting. It's good to talk with another person who's got that military background, or at least a concept and understanding how things work in the world, especially when you talk about the counterterrorism that you identified. Like, you have real, you know, personal experience in regards to knowing what needed to be tackled versus what could be something that could be addressed even more and become part of your objective for your organization. So that's awesome. That's awesome. Thank you for sharing. But how do you think your skills and expertise can contribute to the mission to deliver fund in combating human trafficking? I think you kind of touched on that subject, but I don't know if you wanted to elaborate.
Yeah, when it comes to the fight against human trafficking, it's important for people to understand what we're talking about. I originally thought that human trafficking was an over there issue. It happened in Cambodia, in Thailand, in Guatemala. This is surely something that is not happening in the United States of America. And when you realize that, again, dollar for dollar, the United States of America is the largest human trafficking market on the planet, well, the way that you fight things over there is different than the way that you fight things over here, because we have the Constitution and people have rights. And so it's a different mechanism, but it doesn't mean that a lot of the same methodologies don't apply. So from a skill set perspective, that was really easy for me to translate those skills over, because I essentially had an Ivy League education in hunting down bad guys and doing that in the worst places in the world. And one of the things that I realized with law enforcement in the US is that law enforcement has a very, very tough job, but the rules are very regimented. And the threat is not as high as you see in, say, you know, Kabul. Because think about it. When was the last time, there was a car bomb in the United States of America? Well, it hasn't happened in, I don't even know how long, right? I mean, it just hasn't really happened. Well, that was a weekly, sometimes multiple week occurrence that we would have to deal with. You know, when was the last time, you know, somebody got in a gunfight in the United States of America and the other side had belt-fed weapons? They had RPGs. They had weaponized drones, right? That's not really something that we see here. So what we found was that in working in those environments, human trafficking and things like that really started to take, they didn't even have a seat on the bus. It wasn't that they had a seat at the back of the bus. They didn't even have a seat on the bus, because you're worried about all of these things are going to blow up, that things that are going to kill people really fast. And it seems like in America, and as Americans, we tend to focus on the things that kill people quickly. Suddenly people care a lot about, you know, fentanyl addiction. But human trafficking is something that kills people slowly. The data that I have read says that the average life expectancy of a human trafficking victim is about 7 years before they are murdered or die of an overdose or something happens. And a lot of those overdoses are actually them being murdered by the trafficker, because the trafficker knows that if they give a girl what they call a hot shot of heroin and they OD her, and they just leave the needle in her arm and leave her on a, you know, the motel bed. And when the cops show up, they go, oh, well, just another dead hooker, case closed, right? They don't investigate it as if it were potentially a murder. And so when you take kind of what we learned overseas and things that kill people quickly, and then we said, okay, well, why are we not focused on applying the same level of effort to the things that kill people slowly, like human trafficking, that we do the things that kill people quickly, like drugs and terrorism? And to me, that was a kind of a light bulb moment that says we don't have to choose. We actually can do both. We can fight narcotics and human trafficking with equal levels of efficacy, should we choose to. The question became, why don't we? And I think it's actually really simple. Trafficking victims are not a voting constituency. So our politicians don't properly fund the fight against human trafficking because the public is not demanding that they do so. And I think that's because you have these, when you look at who human trafficking affects, it predominantly affects, while this is changing, it currently predominantly affects socioeconomically depressed areas, predominantly in the inner cities. And it's starting to spread to rural America actually quite rapidly, but for the most part, it's predominantly in the inner cities. And so if we talk inner cities, we talk socioeconomic depression, what people groups are we talking about primarily? We're primarily talking about people of color. And because you have a underrepresentation, then politicians are not willing to put the right amount of resources behind it in order to combat the problem.
That's exactly true. Absolutely. I mean, that's, you are spot on in regards to that, because that's why I've put so much effort into expressing my concern about something. Like, I think it has a lot to do when you mentioned about the Americans are different in regards to how they respond. We have such a short attention span. We don't seem to kind of like have you have to keep our interest. And if there is a 2-minute thing, it's just like on to the next thing. It's like,
right.
We were programmed to be that way. And that's just the technology that we have that's pretty much have put us in a situation where we can't keep our attention long enough to understand and to bring a more of awareness on something like that, that's human trafficking.
So, well, and I think you also have an issue of power differentials, which is something I could talk about for a long time. But when you see, like, if you see somebody who has means and they have a good network and their child, say, goes missing, right? Maybe daughter's making some bad decisions, son is making bad decisions, whatever. The world will move in order to help them. Well, that same thing happens to people who have no network and have no means every single day in our inner cities. And yet the world doesn't even know about it, much less the world move. And so I think it really comes down to what are our priorities as a society? And what do we care about and what do we not care about? And the things that we care about, we will put funding behind. So you see, a great example is where I live. I had a conversation with a city manager. And I love doing this to politicians and people who make these kinds of decisions, because quite frankly, it's a chess game that they can't see coming. And so we start talking about, you know, different crime issues. And so my next question was like, well, you know, what are we doing in this county about human trafficking? What is the city doing about human trafficking? And it was the same response I always get. Oh, it's the most important thing. And, you know, we care about it a lot. And there's lots of wringing of hands and mashing of teeth. And then the question that I ask that makes them all very uncomfortable is, that's amazing that you're taking human trafficking so importantly, and that you're so dedicated to it. Please show me the budget line item that is funding your counter human trafficking team in your law enforcement. And I knew that their law enforcement didn't have one. And then it's, well, you don't understand, because we get this and we get that. And you don't understand. I'm like, I'm a guy who worked for the federal government for 17 and a half years. Like, I understand government and government finance and how it works as well as anybody. So again, why are you not funding a human trafficking task force? Why don't you have a dedicated human trafficking task force? And then he's started to make all these excuses. And like, well, but your gangs task force is probably fully funded. Your property crimes task force, your auto theft unit. So you're telling me that cars are more important than people? Are you telling me that protecting property is more important than protecting people? And you can back them into a corner pretty quick. And so this is, I think, the national conversation we need to be having with our politicians is, show me where you are funding the thing that you are saying you care about. And if you aren't funding it and you're choosing to fund other things instead, then you don't really care about it. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, if we have to take money away from fixing potholes and roads and instead use that money to root human traffickers out of our communities, that's the right decision. And that's what we should be doing.
I was just thinking about, like, do you know what's the root in regards to how we can nip this in the bud? Like, what would be your right on the top of your mind in regards to knowing that you have so much background and expertise and understanding how the business of human trafficking entails? I mean, because I can think right off the bat, like, with human trafficking, do you believe that human trafficking and drugs are kind of like hand in hand? If you eliminate mm-hmm. one, the other one would be lessened or leased to a smaller percentage of minimum of people who are involved in being human trafficked. Do you think that would ever happen in this world?
100%.
Yeah.
I think it could if people cared. I think one of the biggest problems we have is that we have gangs task forces, and then we have a property crime task force, and then we have a narcotics task force, and then we have maybe a human trafficking task force, only usually not. And so we fight these issues in silos. And what works a lot better is to essentially just have a team of very capable people who go after all of them. Mm-hmm. Because the world is so interconnected, right? When we had the 1980s and 90s and Pablo Escobar and these kind of top-down hierarchies of criminal networks, where pretty much everything was controlled by a family or some type of gang. Yes, that made sense. But the way that things work now is we have what I like to call a loose affiliation of like minds, which is that you have these bad guys doing bad things and they work with other bad guys doing bad things, right? So the guy who creates the fake documents no longer just does it for one gang. He does it for all the gangs. No longer just does it for one trafficker. He does it for all the traffickers. The guy who sells illegal guns sells them to everybody. The guy who transports things transports them for everybody. And so this, you have a lot more kind of independent, you can almost call it the criminal gig economy, right? You have this independent network of lone actors that are out there performing one piece of what used to be part of a larger criminal network. So we need to get rid of these silos and these little task forces and instead do it like we do the things overseas. The things that we work on overseas, you don't have, say, a Special Forces ODA who is only focusing on terrorism and then another Special Forces ODA who only focuses on narcotics. No, you have a team of hitters and intelligence people who all go after everything simultaneously. And that's the way we need to start thinking about law enforcement, because the reality is that almost every narcotics case probably has a human trafficking case connected to it. Almost every human trafficking case probably has a illegal gun and, you know, illegal property crime and money laundering and narcotics case attached to it. And so we need to start attacking those systems. Not, people talk about attacking the network. There isn't really a network anymore. And that's kind of my point. We need to attack the system that allows those loose networks to operate. And I think that if we were to take that approach, and like a great example is what I talked about earlier, right? You have the what appears to be a dead prostitute with a needle in her arm in a hotel. Then the detective says, oh, case shut. If they treated that as a homicide and they were legally mandated to treat that as a homicide from day one, well, then we're going to find that, no, that actually is a human trafficking victim. And that's pretty easy to figure out through the online advertisements. It's a human trafficking victim who was killed. Let's find, probably by a trafficker. Let's find out who that is. Okay, now let's find out where he gets the drugs. Now let's find out where he gets the muscle, the guns, the cars, the whatever. Let's put together that entire package. And now let's take everybody down at once. And that's not really what we're seeing. Instead, we see prosecutors, and it's not really the law enforcement officers. It's more of the prosecutors and the administration of the law enforcement departments really just saying, okay, well, let's go after this bad person. Let's get the win. And then let's get the statistics so that we can generate budget to then do it again.
Wow. You know your stuff. Thank you so much for that, because this is something that a lot of people don't know. Like, I mean, just common Joe, like Mike was here. So I thank you very much.
Everybody thinks that law enforcement is an episode of, you know, CSI Miami. And the reality is it could not be farther from the case. But at the same time, if this is what we want to see, well, then we need to support our law enforcement properly. We need to pay them properly. We need to increase the standards for what it takes to become a law enforcement officer. But we also need to increase the pay and decrease the liability so that we can attract better talent. And that's not to say that law enforcement officers aren't talented. I mean, some of them, especially some of those detectives, I mean, they'd be curing cancer if they weren't solving crimes. I mean, they're incredibly brilliant people. But are we seeing an increase in standards and what it takes to become a law enforcement officer in this country? Or are we seeing a decrease in standards? Well, very clearly, we're seeing a decrease in standards. And the reason why we're seeing a decrease in standards is because we're not properly supporting those law enforcement officers. And so, you know, you had this, you know, the defund the police movement, absolutely stupid. And all of the data, and I will debate this with anybody who wants to debate it, all the data shows that defunding the police is the absolute best way to a further degraded society. Now, at the same time, it is true that we were using police for things that police shouldn't be used for, right? Police end up becoming social workers, basically, sometimes, and they end up doing all these things that they shouldn't do. We need our police officers to be essentially the most highly trained and most well-equipped public safety officers that we can possibly make them. And their craft, their trade in going after criminals is violence. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, it's always going, if somebody chooses not to cooperate, they have to be forced to do that. And there's no way to force somebody to cooperate without using violence. So then we need to limit the liability of those law enforcement officers then when they do their job. So there are problems within law enforcement, yes, but we know why those problems happened. Because we haven't seen those problems before, we started seeing a degrading of standards, which came from a degrading of pay and an increase in liability. And then that leads to law enforcement officers making bad decisions, which is very, very few and far between, actually. But because it gets caught on camera, because everyone's got a camera today, then it makes it seem like that's all of law enforcement. And we just, as a society, we can do better.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Because I'm for, to a limit, in regards to defunding. I think it just needs to be rearranged in the funding and how the funding and the budget should be for the law enforcement. Because I think, and you're completely right in regards to the camera, you know, everybody's got a camera. If not the cop, it's someone who is in a public area that is happening and catches it. And then, of course, it goes into another rabbit hole because they weren't there at the time of it began. They were probably at the point where it escalated to the point there was violence in some form. Mm-hmm. Not to completely defund it, but to rearrange the budget. You don't need an AK-47. You don't need to have, like, you know, like all those things. I mean, I guess unless you are dealing with other people who have that type of artillery.
Weaponry, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in Texas, I mean, you can. But I think that when it comes to the training, that's a big plus for me. When it comes to dealing with mental health issues, that's where I kind of draw the line in regards to having a law enforcement try to, okay, de-escalate or whichever, and not have someone mm-hmm. there as a social worker or someone who deals with mental health issues.
Completely agree. Have a trained mental health professional there. Have a law enforcement officer there for security.
Yes.
And to make sure that person, right? Because if you have a 105-pound woman who's a mental health professional who then is going to go talk to a 250-pound mentally ill man, if that man decides to get violent, that's not going to work out well for that woman. So yes, you do need that law enforcement officer there, but only for the security of the social worker, right? Or the mental health professional. It should be the mental health professional that's doing the actual work.
I'm loving this in-depth conversation. I'm so glad that we're able to have this. This is
thanks. They're important conversations. And I think part of the reason why is because we tend to, the world has just become so polarized that we just demonize everybody. And, you know, on one side you have, right, as an example of movements that were kind of opposite each other, you have the Black Lives Matter and the Blue Lives Matter, right? And I have friends in both. I mean, I know the guy who owns Blue Lives Matter as an example. And they're like, when you put people in a room, And I know plenty of folks on the Black Lives Matter side. You're like, you guys have like 80% in common. Because no, anybody who says they want to defund the police doesn't really want to defund the police. Because the next question I say is, okay, well, then when your child gets molested by the soccer coach or whatever, and there's no police, what are you going to do about that? We definitely don't want to go to a world where, you know, we're all vigilantes and we just take the law into our own hands, because then we end up very quickly in a situation where might makes right. And so we don't want to go there. I think we can all agree that we don't want to go there. So we do need police. However, do we need so many police? Because neighborhood policing is dead. All the research is very clear that neighborhood policing doesn't work anymore because nobody knows their neighbors anymore. Everyone's got 100,000 friends on Facebook, but they don't even know who lives next door. And so we don't need patrol cars just cruising around looking for something suspicious anymore, because all of the intel essentially that we need is all online. You know, gangbangers and drug dealers and human traffickers and, you know, gun proliferators, they're all talking about the crime that they're doing online. We can collect everything we need by just passively collecting what they're telling us they're doing and then going out and holding them accountable for those crimes. So you actually could reduce the size of your police force, I think, by 30%. And I agree with not saving that money. You reallocate that money into salaries and benefits and mitigation, risk mitigation for the law enforcement officers, so that you can attract better talent. And when you get better talent, you're going to have better training. You're going to have smarter people who are then going to make better decisions under stress. And so you can see how when you fix a part of the system, you actually end up fixing the whole system, right? So think of it this way. Like, look, let's look at our medical infrastructure in the United States. It's got problems. It's also the best medical infrastructure in the entire world. Having lived in 14 different countries, I can tell you it is absolutely the best. If your child has cancer and you're an oligarch and you live in Serbia, you're trying to get your child into a children's hospital in the United States of America, not a children's hospital in England or in Australia or anywhere else, right? If you are a person of means in any place in the world and you have a medical issue, you're trying to get to the Mayo Clinic. You're trying to get to MD Anderson. You're trying to get to American facilities. So we know we have the best medical system in the world. That doesn't mean there aren't problems, right? So we can keep the good and not destroy the entire system in order to try to root out the bad. Like, let's keep what's good. I think we can all agree that pediatric heart surgeons are probably some of the biggest heroes in the world and are like some very, very good people. But if your child is the one getting heart surgery, do you want your pediatric heart surgeon, who works for a nonprofit hospital or probably a government-funded hospital, do you want that pediatric heart surgeon coming off their second job that they have to work to make ends meet, and now they're tired and they're going to do surgery on your child? Or do you want them waking up in their beautiful home, having a great cup of coffee, getting in their Porsche and enjoying the drive to work and showing up and being like, all right, let's do some surgery? You probably want the latter. Do you want the most talented person operating on your child? Or do you want the person who got the job because they had to fill the slot with somebody? It's a good analogy for where we are with our current law enforcement, right? We expect, and I can tell you as a former professional shooter, where my job was largely to put little pieces of lead where they needed to go to damage the thing that needed to get damaged without damaging anything around it. And I was expected to do that under levels of pressure that most people will never experience even a single time in their entire life. And I was expected to do it perfectly every time. So if that is what we expect, and that's what we expect for law enforcement officers, we talk about how a law enforcement officers, I think it was a case in New York, right, where unfortunately a guy pulled out his wallet and ended up getting shot. And the reason why that happened is because those law enforcement officers were scared. The reason they were scared is because they were undertrained. And then when you look at that case, they ended up firing something like 40 some rounds, of which only a few hit the innocent guy who just pulled out his wallet. Now, in my old unit, if you missed, you were fired. Yeah, right? So like it wasn't an option. If you missed, you were fired. And so there were, when you look at kind of what my old unit was doing and the level of training we had, there were so many circumstances where we could have very justifiably gotten to a shooting, but we didn't. Because we knew that even though that guy had that AK pointed at us, we could see that the safety was on and we were confident that we could actually draw and shoot him before he could take the safety off. So we're able to just de-escalate because we weren't afraid. And, you know, fear in large part comes from lack of having a plan. And when you are in those types of high pressure scenarios, you end up with a lot of fear if you are not properly trained. And all training is helping you to develop plans to deal with situations. We don't need to defund the police at all. Right. We actually need to refund the police. And it's controversial for me to say, but I actually think we should double police budgets on what they spend on actual police officers. There's a lot of administrative bloat and bureaucracy and stuff. All that needs to go away. If you never carried a badge and a gun and you never did that work and you never did it successfully, you should not be allowed to be in a leadership position in law enforcement, period. There's absolutely no room for people to be telling other people to do something they themselves never had the courage to do. Now, that said, we redistribute that money towards better training and better equipment.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I agree a lot of what you just said, identify, because, and that's the right word to say, refund, you know, reallocating the amounts mm-hmm. that should be appropriately applied to the appropriate, you know, even I was even going to mention like maybe having one of the number one things to be trained on is diversity training. Something so that a lot of people are not very understanding of how to approach. Because like for me, I have a dual bachelor's in accounting and business administration. And one of the things we actually had as a class was diversity, how to approach somebody based on their ethnicity, how to talk to them, I have many people of color in my circle. The way you approach a child from a Hmong community could be completely different than approaching a child from a Black community. You never pat them on the head. That's considered, you know, evil spirits or whatever, like based on their religions. You know, that's right. Something that we need to address. I mean, if that's something that they can do, that is a dire need in understanding diversity and how to approach a scenario like that. So
I agree with that, because I do think that there's a lot of, you know, like as an example, when I were in the Middle East, right? I'm a white kid who grew up in Montana. I didn't know anything about Muslim culture. I didn't know anything about the Middle East. And so, you know, I was given classes to help understand the culture I was going to be interacting in. And I think that that is important, because we do have microcultures all over the United States. But and actually, you know, as we were talking about earlier before the podcast, you know, some of those microcultures are actually what lead to an increase in human trafficking, which is an issue that needs to be addressed. However, I also think that we need to do a better job of recruiting from communities that don't traditionally see themselves as an example, a police officer in this case, right? So, you know, rural America, you know, farm kid in Iowa is kind of raised in a way where they see themselves as being in the military, or they see themselves as maybe being a police officer, where in the inner cities, they're not getting that feedback. And let's face it, some of the best police officers in our country are men and women of color who understand the communities that they're policing. So there's something to be said about educating people, but no amount of education that was given to me by the military or the CIA can ever help me to understand the Muslim community overseas in the way that somebody who grew up in that community understands it. I think the education piece is important, but I think it's a small piece. I think we need to do a better job of recruiting from those communities. Now, recruiting from those communities doesn't start with like, oh, we're doing a job fair at the local high school. That's dumb, right? It goes, the recruiting piece should go into long term, right? So it should be where kids in those communities see law enforcement officers in their schools regularly. They see them in their communities having positive interactions regularly. They have law enforcement officers coming in and talking to them about, hey, like you can do, law enforcement officers who look like them, who are from their neighborhoods. Maybe they don't live in their neighborhoods now, but they're from those neighborhoods coming in and saying, hey, you know, I had a tough childhood. I had whatever. I get you. I feel you. I know where you came from because I used to be you. In fact, I sat in that desk right over there because I went to this high school. And this is what I did. And now I'm this police officer. And let me tell you how great of a job this is. And this is something you can do too. It's a generational process. And I think that if we as a society decided that we were serious about, say, bringing more people of color into policing, because I think that's the solution. I think it's who do you want policing a county in rural Iowa? Probably somebody who grew up in that county in rural Iowa or something similar to it. And who do you want policing inner city Chicago? Probably somebody who grew up in that community. Because you end up, right, we have this prosecutorial and law enforcement discretion, which is really important. And so the kid who grew up as an Eagle Scout in rural Iowa, who is now policing inner city Chicago, sees a kid do something stupid. You know, put graffiti on the side of a building or something like that, and doesn't understand because that's not the culture he came from. And so he disproportionately responds. Where a law enforcement officer who grew up in that community probably says, okay, we're going to go to the local, you know, store. We're going to get some soap and some Scotch Brights, and you're going to clean this off, and I better not see you doing it again. And so there's kind of a punishment, but it's nothing that affects that child's life long term. And so I think we have to start thinking about this generationally and not thinking about it through the lens of the current adult population. I think we have to actually go all the way down to grade school and start thinking about it generationally through the lens of the current child population. And then that's how we actually solve these problems in a way that they will stay solved.
I completely agree about that. Thank you for sharing that, because that's a good piece to talk about as well. Maybe we can talk about any testimonies that you'd like to share, if there is any. I guess, for example, like any stories that you would like to bring to the spotlight. We can talk about active missing persons that you're working on, or that kind of came across your desk, if you work with them directly, or how does that come to?
Sure. How does that work?
Yeah.
So we have a centralized technology stack. So a bunch of different technologies that are involved in that. And what we do is we give law enforcement free access to that. That's why donors are so important to us, because law enforcement, again, we just talked about all the problems with law enforcement. They don't have any money. And it's not the law enforcement officer's fault. It's the politician's fault for not properly funding these types of problems. And it's why politicians, let's just say, they don't invite me to speak very often, because they basically just point out how they're doing a bad job. So we have created this platform that's for free for law enforcement, and we not only give them training, what is human trafficking and what is not human trafficking, but also how to use online tools and then our tech stack in order to be able to coordinate cases across the country. I mentioned that law enforcement is not an episode of CSI Miami earlier. And what I mean by that is law enforcement doesn't have the technical capability that people think they do, and they're not very well connected. So if you have, say, a young girl who goes missing in Tampa, Florida, and she is now being, let's say she's being trafficked in Oklahoma City. So this is a real case. The Tampa law enforcement officer is not connected with the Oklahoma City law enforcement officer, unless they're feds. And you're looking at, it's something like a 200-to-1 state and local to federal officer ratio there's just not very many federal officers, and they tend to be dealing with like the much bigger things. And not that one missing child is not a big issue, but they're trying to take down, say, a terrorist network or something, right? So they don't have time to focus on that one missing kid. So that's what we do, is we tie all of these law enforcement departments and NGOs, select NGOs who need the capability. We tie them all together within one centralized platform, and the artificial intelligence in the platform will tell them if they have commonality in their cases. This phone number in your case is the same as this phone number in my case. Let's talk. So we basically create a permissionless de facto federal task force out of state and local law enforcement officers and prosecutors. So that, and prosecutors love us for the work that we do. So that's kind of how we do it. But one of the things I think it's important for your listeners to understand is how trafficking happens. So let's nerd out on numbers. And as a business administrator and accountant, I know that you love numbers as much as I do. So in a five-year period, you mentioned the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which is a phenomenal, phenomenal organization. Our country, quite frankly, owes them a debt of gratitude and owes John Walsh a debt of gratitude for setting it up. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children in a five-year period found that they had an 846% increase in suspected child trafficking cases. So think about that. 846% increase in only 5 years. Why did that happen? Smartphones, which are broadband connected microcomputers that are in everybody's pocket, that make it so that somebody can order a girl to a hotel room for the same way that they can order a pizza and for about the same price. So we've commoditized primarily women and girls. Yes, this happens to boys, and yes, this happens to men, but this is predominantly a women and girls issue. And so, and it's predominantly men who are driving the demand for those women and girls, right? It's not a woman who is ordering that girl to her hotel room. It's a man who's doing that, right? And who are those men? Predominantly upper middle class to wealthy, white collar jobs. That's who it is, right? That's who the oppressor in this case is. And I use the word oppressor very specifically because that's what they are doing to those young girls who get ordered up to their hotel room. And so how does that girl get there? Well, we go back to that 846% increase in suspected child trafficking, that because of smartphones. So it used to be like, so I'm 46 years old. So when I grew up, it was the wrong side of the tracks. There were the girls walking the streets, right? It was, and then everybody knew there was a creepy guy on the other side of town who would exploit people. And so parents would just keep their kids away from that guy. Well, now what we have done with smartphones and social media apps and the algorithms that kind of connect us all, it's math that's connecting us all. These algorithms are helping that creepy guy on the other side of town access every single child in the United States who has a smartphone. So what we did was we gave predators, instead of only access to the prey that they could physically get in contact with, we now gave those predators access to all of the prey, and the algorithms within social media are their targeting platforms. So the reality of human trafficking in America today, and this is very important for your listeners to understand, is that it's not the white van with free candy going through the neighborhood that's going to abduct the child. It's your daughter being upset with you because you won't let her wear the mini skirt because she's trying to wear some age inappropriate clothing, which I grew up with three sisters. At some point, this is all young girls, right? And in my day, she would go into a room and she would write angsty things in her journal and listen to some, you know, angsty music. And that was the end of it. Today, she gets on TikTok and makes a video saying she's mad at her dad or mad at her mom for not letting her wear the mini skirt. And that trafficker slides right into her DMs and starts telling her all the things that she wants to hear, like, oh, that's just because you're so pretty and your parents are trying to keep you from growing up. And hey, let me send you an Amazon gift card, and manipulates her and befriends her and grooms her over a period of weeks, months, sometimes years, and then convinces her to run away into the arms of somebody that she thinks cares for her, but is really somebody who's going to exploit her. And then she becomes a missing person. So it doesn't work like it used to. It's not abductions anymore. Now, does that still happen? Sure. But when you look also at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children data, you find that of their missing children cases in 2022, 0.0001% of those cases were stranger abductions. 92% of those cases are what they call endangered runaways. And most of those endangered runaways were groomed online and convinced to run away by somebody that they thought was going to take care of them, right? Who's going to answer all of their questions and fill that essentially God-sized hole in their heart. So when you start looking at how that young girl is trafficked, how she shows up to the hotel room in the first place, it's incredibly important to understand that it's the internet that makes all of that happen, to include the initial recruiting. Now, I've heard some parents go in the absolute extreme, and that's why I don't give my children access to the internet. I'm like, well, that's like saying that you're not going to teach your children to read. In the modern environment, your children have to have access to the internet. They have to be able to make good choices around the internet. It's akin to parents saying that, well, I'm going to keep my children under my roof and not let them talk to anybody because I'm afraid they might be exposed to drugs. Well, eventually they're going to leave and they will be exposed to drugs. 100% chance that happens. So how do we educate them so that when that does happen, they can make the best decision? And if they do make a mistake, they can come to us and we can help them fix that mistake. The internet is exactly the same thing. It's the new drugs, if you will. And every single child has access to it or will have access to it. Every young girl will at some point be solicited online or will have some creepy guy coming in and into their DMs and trying to solve all their problems. So we need to make sure to educate them how to properly deal with those situations and how to, if they do make a mistake, they do send a photo that they wish they wouldn't have sent, how to actually work with us as parents or work with authority figures to solve that problem.
Absolutely. I always pronounce them NCMEC as a acronym.
Yeah, NCMEC.
Yeah, so NCMEC. A lot of things that are coming out with the programs and the awareness, it, like from sexting, dealing with, or
sextortion, they call
sextortion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they do that for children. I mean, you know, let me see that. Oh, come on, you know, or whichever, coercing them to do it. And they think, oh, well, you know, they're not going to share it. Or it's just one pic. What is it going to do? And it does more damage. And that's where that can lead to ending their lives because of the embarrassment or the shame that comes out of that.
Or getting trafficked.
Or getting trafficked.
You know, that's pretty common. And so I think it's also important for us as parents to not be so judgmental. I mean, thank God smartphones and the internet did not exist when I was growing up, because there's no evidence of a lot of the stuff that I did.
Yes, exactly. And
so children have it so much harder today. Mm-hmm. They have so many more problems that they have to be able that they have to deal with that we never had to deal with. So as parents, it's important for us to educate ourselves, but also not be so judgmental and understand that there are problems that children today have had to deal with that no children in history have ever had to deal with. And those problems are created by the internet. And so, you know, if you or I, when we were growing up, if there was a photo that we didn't want to get out, there was probably just one photo. And we could burn that photo. We could throw it away. We could destroy it now, right? And it was very difficult to replicate that photo. I remember back in the day when you had to order, like, you had to order copies from Walgreens. You had to tell them how many copies of a photo you wanted, right? And you're like, oh, there's five of my friends, so I guess I'll take five copies, right? I mean, that was a hard process, and it took a week to then get them back. Now it's instantaneous. It can be replicated for no cost across the entire globe in seconds. No child population has ever had to grow up in those circumstances. And so it's important for us, I think, as parents to not be so judgmental when kids do make a mistake, and instead say, okay, I made mistakes too when I was young. However, the consequences of the current environment are significantly higher than they ever were when we were growing up. And so we need to help them solve those problems as fast as possible. And because I know people are going to ask, well, if my child does something, what do I do? Let's ting it all the way back to our original part of our conversation. You call law enforcement. You call your county sheriff, you call your police department, you call the FBI, you call the Department of Homeland Security, you call everybody, and you don't stop calling them until somebody answers you and starts taking your case seriously. And luckily, law enforcement officers in this day and age, for the most part, there's always exceptions, but for the most part, they take this issue very seriously. They know what to do, and they will immediately take action. And not only do you want to contact law enforcement, but if your child does send a photo to somebody that they probably shouldn't have sent, the other organization that you want to immediately contact is the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And you want to tell them what's going on. They will do what's called a hat. They will create a hash of the photo, which is essentially the mathematical algorithm of the photo. So not the actual photo. And then they will then enter that into a series of software that a lot of companies have that will make sure that if somebody tries to say share that photo on Facebook or Instagram or something, it will automatically catch it and strip it out.
Wow, that's good detail. And that's information that I did not know about. But thank you for sharing that, because that's something, again, like someone would not know until it does happen. We're trying to prevent from getting to the point of this happening, but to know that there are things already set in place. So that's very...
Kids are going to make mistakes.
Oh,
we need to create solutions for those mistakes and not just say, well, these are the consequences. I'm sorry, they're life altering.
Exactly. You have an app called Deliver Funds Human Trafficking Safeguard. And how can how can people access this if they are interested?
Yeah, you just go to the Apple Store or Google Play Store if you have an Android and search Deliver Fund. That's D-E-L-I-V-E-R Fund. Or you can search HT Safeguard. It stands for Human Trafficking Safeguard. Just download the app. It costs $1.99 a month in order to access the data. But what it does is we collect commercial sex advertisements off the internet and we clean it up and make it so that it's queryable. So if you have a phone number of somebody that you think is a little bit sketchy or an email address, you can actually search it in that app and you can see whether or not that phone number or email address is tied to a commercial sex advertisement. And if it is, then you know that you can do some further investigating to find out whether or not that's somebody you want to continue to interact with.
Wow, that's great.
Or you want to have your child continue to interact with.
Right, exactly. But yeah, that's amazing. Wow. Now, if people wanted to contribute to your cause or share information about your organization, are you able to provide like links, resources, your contact number or person in general who they can, just anything that you could share would be great to the listeners and how they can reach out and contribute to your cause?
So the best way to get a hold of us is going to be through our website, which is deliverfund.org. There's a donate button on there. So if you have some extra capital that you want to invest in the fight against human trafficking, we're a darn good use of that money. And then we also have resources for training and different things in order to help people learn more about human trafficking. And then follow us on social media. So we're at Deliver Fund on all the social media platforms. And I'm at the.nick.mckinley on all the social media platforms. And we put up a lot of information there. So, you know, if you follow us, you'll get a daily little snippet of human trafficking education in your feed.
That's awesome. Thank you. I'm definitely following you if I haven't already.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much again, Nick. It's been an honor to speaking with you.
Ed, thank you for having me. I appreciate you.
If you enjoy our show, please rate us on Apple or Spotify. And be sure to come back and listen to us every other Thursday. Until then, this is Jasmine Castillo. We are Voiceless No More. Proud member of Darkcast Network, Uncovered.com, Transdoe Task Force, Crime Survivors for Safety and Justice, and partner with Search and Support San Antonio and Seasons of Justice.